Hi, Ryan.
Hi, Rachel. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Sound better than you. I don't feel like I'm in the dumps, but you sound like you're a bit in the dumps. What's happening?
Jakar forced his eye, Ryan. I'm upset.
I am
upset. Katarja lives and Jakar lost an eye, and I'm not happy about it.
I see. Unlike one of Jakar's eyes. So, Rachel, that is very emotional. We'll get into the whole losing of an eye and Katarja. We love him. I love that guy. He, nothing wrong. Did everything right.
He needs to be dead.
No, he's...
He needs to be dead.
Rachel, calm down. He's a living god. How can you defeat that?
He's about to ascend to godhood. He's not a god yet.
But that's why you can go to Narn, because who can touch a living god? Yeah, exactly right. It's the madman logic. But Rachel, talking about madman logic, not the TV show Mad Men. That's a great show. But could you please remind us where Yum Yum came from? Was that from Mad Men?
No.
No?
I doubt, just in case you're new and you don't know the origin of Yum Yum in this particular incident, it is a phrase that is just used usually in response to food.
Oh, yeah.
And it is in other media. But
It's a phrase, yeah.
We named our podcast after a very specific use of Yum Yum, where we think it was totally fucking ridiculous and a very odd response to being asked to go murder somebody.
What series would do that, Rachel?
Star Trek Discovery.
Wait, a Star Trek show would
do
that? So are we talking about Star Trek Discovery today?
No.
Oh.
Thankfully we are.
Then why did I watch an episode of it right before this recording? You're telling me I watched All In again by myself for no reason? Dang it. I'll phone up our friend Steve from the Last Best Babylon 5 podcast to re-record it. He'll talk to me about it again.
No, I won't.
He will, though.
Yeah.
Steve, you're up. You're up now, buddy. Come on, let's talk about All In again. But no, we're talking about...
But he won't be listening to this.
I'll send him this exact sound clip and he'll come in. He'll come in. He'll do it. He's a good boy. But we're actually here to talk about a good science fiction television series, Babylon 5. Isn't that right?
Yes, that's B5? What I was trying to say.
Oh, were you? Oh, I'm so sorry. I was too
and
busy thinking about All In.
You are about to give us the DVD brochure's description of this episode of Babylon 5, because that's the kind of summary that
we have the physical media, because who can rely on the internet? Digital. No, they can just remove it off of streaming platforms or digital platforms, but the DVDs, those are eternal.
Bye-bye, Looney Tunes.
Bye-bye, Looney Tunes. Hello, that episode 4, Falling Toward Apotheosis, which, according to the DVD, goes as such. That's right. Sorry. Taking out the trash, 23rd century style, while Sheridan seeks to rid B5 of the Vorlon ambassador, Malari begins his wily scheme to thwart Katarja. Delenn learns that Sheridan's days are numbered. So that is the episode's description, and make sure, people, if you've not given this a watch yourself, we say to you, you should. We spoil things. We're a rewatch podcast. We're looking at Babylon 5 from that prism, the prism where we go back to it, look over it again, and see how it all ties together to the grander themes and narratives and plot points of the series. And this one has a lot happening, specifically when it comes to our main man Sheridan and his life expectancy.
Garibaldi.
Oh yeah, Garibaldi. I was gonna hold on to Garibaldi because we've got an answer to the question: who had YYE, Yum Yum Energy? The person who would say Yum Yum if given the chance, and my candidate is Garibaldi in this episode. He was very energetic, wild, unpredictable, truly a yum yum energy man. Thoughts?
Yeah, I see that. I think Lorien is a contender as well. I do think Garibaldi takes the trophy. I agree with that. But I wanna bring up Lorien. I also wanna bring up the first security guard that gets shot by Kosh.
Oh yeah. God there bless you. Them. I hope they're okay.
I got a message from the captain. Because of your government's recent attacks on the League of Non-Aligned Worlds, we're asking you to leave at once.
History relationship with falling toward apotheosis, same as it is today as I watched it. This episode kicks ass. I like it. It's very entertaining. It's enthralling. It has that JMS style of narratives where you have the big moments, the game-changing moments, the things that are going to ripple out as we go forward, while still finding time for the small, quiet character beats. It is everything I like in a Babylon 5 episode. It has pretty much most of the roster of characters are in this episode. Pretty much everyone gets their time to shine. The only person taking a break this week, I think, is Veer. He wasn't here.
No.
He sat out, but don't worry. Zach was here.
Zach's here. So much Zach action.
We got some Leeta. You know I love Leeta. Rachel, falling toward apotheosis. Tell us about what you think of it.
It's another example of season 4 being all killer, no filler.
Doesn't waste any time.
Nope. Every second is working for the episode. To the point where they layer it up.
Oh, yeah.
The particular thing that I noted was they do that in a few different ways, but the screen-on-screen action in this episode was very prevalent.
There's a lot of
screen-on-screen. So they use that to create transitions between scenes. So it's just like something's still happening while they're setting up the next thing.
We were watching a scene and now it's zoomed out and it's on a TV screen of another character watching that thing.
How little time they have and how much they're milking it is that they don't even want to spend seconds.
This is JMS
on transitions.
No, this is JMS looking while typing out his script, looking at his watch going, I could cut off another 2 seconds on this page. Delete. And it's great. It really glides. And you bring up a valiant and brilliant point of valiant. Noble, heroic point about the transitions. To even go to how it layers on from where we were off on the last episode. Last episode, we concluded with, well, guys, the Vorlons, they've gone crazy. They're blowing up planets now. What do we do? And then this episode, Ivanova opens up with her Ivanova reports where it's just, hello, these planets have been just destroyed. And it keeps escalating throughout the episode. These planets, and here's where all of these refugees can go. And oh no, that planet where we told them to go is now destroyed. We'll get some more up for you in a moment if we can. And the fear and the panic that she has as a character within her, as well as the people who are affected and watching the reports, increases over the course of the episode. But you just hit off from where we were last episode, but you skip forward to the inevitable rise of that action. The Vorlons are on the warpath. No, guys, we're not going to diddle about for a bit of the episode to eventually get them to here.
No.
We're going to kick off the next episode where they've already destroyed several planets.
Yes.
Everyone knows.
Credits, seeing the planet killer.
We're preempting your normal Babcom service to bring you another update in the continuing crisis. 2 more deep-range planetary colonies have been eliminated by Vorlon forces.
The Ivanova newsreel reports and the Vorlon attacks are a framing device. They help move along the individual plots that we have going on. And I really appreciated its implementation, both of those things, in the episode, because when I was writing down my notes, I was looking at how the stories that we do have, the Londo, the Garibaldi, the Sheridan, and the Vorlon stuff, on their own individual things, are all good, but not great.
No.
But what makes them great is how we make them all connect together and weave together, whether it's whether it's Londo phoning up Sheridan, or it is the Ivanova reports just helping connect it all. I just really liked the framing device of this episode.
Love the little Lita moments that we get in that as well, because every character is present for the moment that they're needed, and all of their reactions you understand because you know them. You know where Zach is at, being Garibaldi's second in command, and what, like, understanding why Garibaldi is so paranoid when everybody else is just done with his bullshit, and why Lita would be so willing to risk everything to kill this Vorlon.
We have had...
Everything's there.
We have had, over the last three episodes, so many different plots happening. Each character with their own goals in mind. And sometimes they line up, sometimes they don't.
Mm.
But in this, we have still all of these characters with their own things in mind. But now with the Vorlons attacking, everybody that is in this episode is working under the same pressure of the Vorlons' madness and destruction eventually catching up with them. So Londo doing the Centauri Palace intrigue no longer feels just as this secondary story that's over here while Delenn and Sheridan are doing this. Everybody here is worried about the Vorlons, and so they all have a timer that they have to work under.
The threat is ever present.
And the Vorlons don't really do anything within this episode. All you get is ominous shots of CGI ships floating through debris and the evil Kosh on the ship just looking at the camera while the smoke in his room whirls about. And that's it. That's all you need. But their actions off screen is so overbearing on Londo, on Sheridan, on Lita, on even, on even Garibaldi to an extent. It's really
the
well
war
done.
Is on.
It truly is on. And so throughout each one of the storylines we go through, pretty much the Vorlons and their atrocities bleeds through each one of them, because I want to talk about Londo, of course. I want to get into Londo first, because is this the most entertaining storyline in season 4? Just in general?
Oh, yeah, the Centauri stuff is like the best stuff.
Yeah?
Yeah. Like, it's all great. Like, pretty much all of the storylines in the season 4 are like S tier stories.
I agree. They're very, very good.
We are both in the camp of, like, the show is Londo's show.
If there's any character that you think about the arc of the most, it's Jakar and Londo. They're a pair. You can't separate them. And yeah, there's just something about the Centauri stuff in season 4, because I guess throughout the other three seasons, it's been in the distance, and we've only had Londo. And we've had visitors come in and rivals and that. But here it's on the homeworld, and it's nothing but the Centauri Palace royal court drama, which has always been in the background of Londo's plots in previous episodes. So when we get in season 4, it's nothing but that. And it feels so rewarding and tasty. You've just been salivating over it, because in the other ones we've had the Coming of Shadows or anytime Lord Reefer pops up, You get the
glimpses into the Centauri world before this, but now you are in it. You are in the thick of it. You are seeing it all play out. You are witnessing Londo reap what he sowed.
And that's what is a huge factor of my entertainment of the Centauri plot is all of these shots of Londo's mortified face at the repercussions to the actions he has taken. And he's realizing that these are the repercussions. Before, he didn't factor these in.
No.
He didn't know. Mm-hmm. He's now standing there looking at Kataja. Every single time Kataja calls him into a place, he comes in panicked, worried, flustered, on edge.
Which is it's so great that Londo calls the Emperor into the throne room this episode.
Because he has a ploy and he's confident in it. And there's a catharsis to seeing Londo get what he deserves. And even if it's to the extent of he's deeply uncomfortable, because he's done so many atrocious things. So I delight in absolute joyous sense when he walks into a scene with Kataja and he takes a sigh and he grits his teeth and he worries that the next thing he says could get him killed. I'm smiling from ear to ear because you deserve it. He deserves it. He deserves this.
Mm-hmm.
This is the type of hell he's given himself and he deserves to live in it. But the experience is to see him claw his way out, because that's a Londo character. You see him build the prison that he makes for himself, and you have to watch him break out of it each time, and then build a new one. That's how I would describe some of his character journey, and eventually we'll see him not be able to get out. But we come into it with Kataja in the garden area outside, looking up at the stars, looking up at the sky, and we know he's insane. We know this. But do you ever just have that moment where you cut to a scene of Kataja and you see a different way that Wortham Krimmer is just making us know through the eyes or his smile that he's crazy?
Yeah, the eyes were a big one for that in that scene. Like, the way that he opens his eyes too widely in an uncomfortable way, that his smile feels more like a grimace.
He has the type of eyes that, are made for acting because they can do multiple things at the same time. We see this throughout the story when he's interacting with Londo and how he flips from being in love with Londo to despising him. And it's this intensity where when he's looking up at the sky, you see both of these things where his stare is so intense that nothing can avoid their gaze.
Yeah.
And yet it's looking through. Like, he's also got that emptiness in those eyes.
Yeah, it's vacant.
But yet, they're the type of eyes that when they look at you, you know that he's seeing you, and you don't want that. It's the way that this actor can flick between those two things of being someone who's super aware to someone who's super unaware is what makes Kataja such a dangerous character in every single scene he's in.
Yeah, because that's a big part of his unpredictability. They thought that they could control him.
Mm-hmm.
And they can't because he is buck wild.
Majesty, this is intolerable. To send our people out to defend their ships.
Get so exercised at times like this, Malari. Really, I wish I had a picture of your face right now.
This is serious.
Of course it is. And I have no intention of sending our ships out there.
Morden came back, by the way, in this opening scene with Kataja. I almost forgot about Morden, but then
he
came
less
in.
Less crispy.
What do you think about Morden and his crispiness? And
I fucking love it. I fucking love it.
He comes.
Is there another response that you were expecting from me?
I can't get past that. This is the arc for Morden, where there's just a crispy arc, where there's just a crispy burnt arc, where we see him slowly heal.
He's renewing.
It's just very, very amusing to me. And he's crazy now. Like, he's always been evil,
yeah,
he's insane.
He's openly done with
Londo.
Londo especially, but just, like, the formalities of life.
And the pretense of sanity, because there's that whole speech he gives about how if you guys send your ships up there and show them that you're willing to be chaotic and aggressive and basically be the shadow ideology, they'll back down because of your superior dominance and they'll respect you. And it's like, Morden would never openly say that in the past, but now there's no reason not to.
He's no filter.
He's no filter. He's completely unhinged. Ed Wass is having the time of his life.
Time of his life.
That's a huge reason too why the Centauri Prime plot is great. Yeah. Every single actor is having the time of their life.
Like, making
this is
the
greatest.
Most of it.
They're making a meal out of it. And Kataja being unpredictable yet again, when Londo pleads with him, this is crazy, don't do this, this is wrong, he agrees. He says, I'm not going to send those ships up there, of course I'm not. That's absolutely silly. I wouldn't do that. And
because I'm just going to let the Forlorns kill everybody.
Did you see that coming? Did you? I remember my jaw hit the floor when he did the, oh, I'm not going to send the ships up there. I'm like, what? Okay.
Yeah, I remember being like, okay, what crazy thing do you want to do instead? Do you think that you can project a bubble and protect the entire planet?
I thought he wanted to kill the shadows himself. I was like, is he that crazy?
No. I knew that he was like, wouldn't go there.
Well, a part of me did because he sees himself as a god, and yet he has to bow down to these people who see themselves as god, and I just think he's crazy enough to want to have a go at that. Mm. And so I really was caught off guard when his plan is, well, Rachel, you've already said it, he's willing to
let the world burn.
He can't just say that in the garden, though, because there's people listening. So he has to make sure to take Londo to a special place that only a few people have ever gone to. And we've seen this place before.
The inner sanctum.
His shadow cabinet, as he calls it. we've seen it before.
Yeah.
His table covered in heads. And I always flip-flop on this. I always flip-flop on, would this have been more impactful if we hadn't seen it in the first episode of season 4 and seen it now? Because we get told about it in season 4, episode 1, and then we also see it. And I always wonder if it would have been more of an oomph if we saw it for the first time with Londo and seeing Kataja's craziness in this level where he's talking to them.
It would be different.
And you know what? I slap myself and go, no, this way is great because I'm too busy laughing at Londo's terror. And if it was presented the other way, I think I would have to try and not be as amused and pleased with the scene. But since I already know about these table of heads and how he interacts with them, I get a great amount of enjoyment now seeing Londo have the realization that I did 3 episodes ago about it.
Yeah, it's like, oh, did you not believe Vereening?
They say that he has a table covered in heads. It's a rumor, though. Ooh. Kataja, we talked about.
Did we get Vereening in this?
No, Vereening. He had a little break today, too. We talked about this in our spotlight section for Wortham Krimmer or Robert Krimmer. That JMS became more aware of the humorous way he was playing the character, and so he wrote shtick for him. He wrote some bits, and we have that in the shadow cabinet scene. That line even is more of an overt comedy line than what Kataja had in
whole
other
thing
ones.
About the cough,
and what about Rachel? The highlight of the scene. Come on, You laugh at it. I laugh at it. He's describing that he's going to let everyone burn. He's not going to help anyone. He's going to leave the ships here on the ground. But Londo looks concerned. So what does he do to alleviate his concern? Rachel? Come on. Katarj is a big kid, remember? In Londo's eyes, he's a shitty baby or pervert teenage boy. So what does he offer him? Too busy laughing? You want some Snicks? Some random Centauri ribbon candy? I adore it very much.
The Snicks?
Yeah.
I adore Londo with the handkerchief.
Because it stinks in there.
Yeah.
Did you know that the Centauri minister, the one that had the cough, that guy... That the head of that guy is, at least from what I know in trivia-wise, is Andreas Katsoulis. That's just him. He just, why not? Just, he's a weird face.
Yeah, he does.
He could look like a decomposing head. Let's just get him. And so if you actually look at it, you can see how it's clearly Andreas Katsoulis, but as a decomposing head with a big wig on it.
Yeah.
Just a piece of fun. And... it doesn't distract me from the scene knowing that trivia. I just go, oh, if I remember it, I go, oh, that's a piece of fun. And I enjoy it because it's in a funny scene or a darkly funny scene. I can imagine someone listening to this going, oh, I didn't find that at all funny. And I'm sorry, guys. Katarj is a laugh out loud riot every time he shows up. Is that a question? That's a question I have to ask. Have you ever found Katarj genuinely scary?
Not scary. He's a menace. But I'm scared for the Centauri people. But I don't find him as a figure scary.
I agree. I'm just too engaged with the character to find him scary. Rarely do I ever find the mad king scary emperor actually terrifying. Usually I find them greatly amusing, enthralling, laugh out loud, entertaining, because as we have stated, they're doing such depraved, obnoxiously arrogant, cruel things to a degree that it almost flips around to being entertaining a lot of the time, especially when they're this decadent and flamboyant. It's different to, say, him being Hitler, right? He's Caligula. He's not Hitler. And so there's a difference there, because his insanity is just this type where you can see where Londo's called him to the palace, to the throne room, and he's pissed off. And it makes me smile that the fact that this guy who's done this to a million people all the time, including Londo, he doesn't like it when it's happening to him. He's like a petulant child about it.
That's my thing.
You don't invite me late into the night into the throne room. I invite you late into the night into the throne room. How could you?
I'm in charge.
Londo has a reason, though. You want to talk to us all about what Londo has cooking?
Londo wants to get his doofus off world to make it easier to kill him. So he's like, well, if everybody's dead, who is going to worship you?
Who's going to be left?
Who's going to sing your praises and go to your temple? So you need interplanetary fame. So if we go to Narn to kill Jakar...
who I hate, by the way. By the way,
I'm going to be the one to kill Citizen Jakar.
By the way, Londo, totally want to kill Citizen Jakar, because that's my character, right? Mm-hmm. Wink. Peter Jurisic does... oh, the facial acting from him is always top tier, but when you have Katarj in there and he has to bite his lip through so much, because the character's always so wordy, him having to speak things through other words just through that face is
He is doing so much in those moments, and Katarj agrees, because they'll make it back to Centauri Prime before it gets exploded.
Katarsh is happy about that. Hey, it lines up quite well, actually. We'll do this, do that. Londo even tries to
there, a day for trial.
We could half a day. We know he's guilty, but Katarsh, being the man of vanity and ego he is, no. We wouldn't want to deprive those Narns of my glory.
We need time to expose them.
Being infallible, you have to contend with how fallible everybody else is. Oh, boy. As he says in the final scene that we move to, because he has agreed to go there because Londo, being the master manipulator he is, he pulls at those cords and puppets him so well because he plays to those insecurities of Katarsh of being forgotten, not being known, which is going to happen if he lets the whole planet get destroyed. So let's move
without doing this first.
Without doing this first.
We definitely need to make this whole planet a funeral pyre for you.
For you. And we have the final sequence where Londo is just, go, go, go. I've got to get everything lined up. I know that I have to kill this guy, figure out how to do that on the flight over. Make sure that when I come back, if I'm not caught, to arrange it so that we get rid of all of the shadow presence that's still here. And that's going to be something I'm going to have to literally fight to do, because Morden has very much showed his hand that you can't fuck with us. So he's Mr. Business. So in that final sequence, he's too busy to kind
he's
of
preoccupied.
Contend the fact that when Katarsh says, I don't like the way that Jakar's looking at me, that guy's looking at me, what do you think I should do? Londo kind of is oblivious to the fact that he's having a conversation with a violent, murderous madman.
Yeah.
Who, when he says, your judgment will be best for this, doesn't think, oh yeah, of course Katarsh will like mutilate and or do something horrid, not just put a bag over his head or move to another room, you know, like a normal person. No. And you cried about it at the beginning. You bemoaned this. We know for a fact that in future visions, consistently, Jakar has had the eye patch. He's had the eye patch. Yep. Did you ever really think about how that would come into pass?
First watch through, no. No, I was just like, it'll happen sometime. I did not think it would happen now. But it makes sense because it's a very visible cost. We saw the cost of his pride in the other episode, and now he's physically mutilated as punishment.
It's just giving you that sinking feeling in your gut of, we haven't avoided that future we saw. Oh, the prophecies that we've been told are still coming into pass. We had that with Katarsh saying, let it burn, let it all burn in fire. And it makes you think about Kosh and the coming of shadows, where he tells the Centauri Emperor how it will all end in fire.
You see it, don't you? If I become a god, how will our world survive without me? I cannot just abandon it. That would be cruel. And anyone who followed me would obviously be inferior. Best to put them out of their misery. I will take it all with me in spirit. Don't send the ships. Let it burn, Malari. Let it all end in fire.
Londo isn't as paranoid as he should be in that scene. You know who got his paranoia?
What?
Who? Garibaldi. Garibaldi's got enough paranoia to fuel a small city.
And he's already got yum yum energy. This guy's got so much stuff happening in that big bald dome of his.
That's shaved still.
That's Jerry Doyle for you. He got a haircut at the start of every season just to fuck with them. They told him, don't cut your hair. And every season he would cut his hair and shave it. And eventually he's just bald. That's what Jerry Doyle would do. Have I told you this before? I think we've said this on the podcast at one time.
I can't remember.
If you watch season one and then season two, He got a haircut in between his, like, during his coma, I guess. And then same with season 3 to season 4. It's like, oh, I guess when he got abducted by shadows, they also gave him a buzz. Yep. And he keeps doing it. And
yeah.
You know what? Good job. It's what what a troll. You teach high school students.
Yes.
Isn't that a high school student arrogant type of pricky move? Where you're like, now, Jaden, don't do that. And then they do that. Oh, he's a high school student, Jerry Doyle.
That's Jerry Doyle's energy.
He had another energy to the Garibaldi factor. He's got paranoia, yum-yum, and high school energy. That's too much. He might overload. But what is going on with Garibaldi?
He is super suspicious. We start with him watching secure cam footage, which he should not have access to, and he's using a very weird remote control.
Yeah, that's the Babylon 5 remote thing. It's a remote. It's the remote. That's what a TV remote looks like in the future. And can I say, why not? Do you ever look at our TV remote and think to yourself, why do we still have chunky black TV remotes that had when we were kids?
No.
I don't know why that hasn't changed.
I don't. I appreciate that because I know that there's a whole section of the internet dedicated to solutions that people have to not losing their Apple TV remotes. Like attaching it to a plank of wood, putting a tile or an air tracker of some sort on it, and that little stick is too small for the ladder options.
Sheridan loses his ring in this episode, and yet Garibaldi can keep track of that little TV remote of his. Shows you the difference between these two men. Garibaldi, he doesn't let anything out of his sight. Sheridan lets things slip all the time. And that's what Garibaldi has a bit of a stick up his ass about. We all have to believe that this weirdo freak alien that he met on the evil alien planet is a good dude. And
because the captain vouches for him.
And I smile and cheer and pump my fist in that opening scene with him and Zach, because he's right.
He's
God
right.
Damn it.
He's right. He's being a jerk about it, but he's right.
But he's always a jerk. It's Garibaldi. That's the thing, is this whole storyline where Garibaldi is an asshole, you flip-flop on it because you go, yeah, he's being an asshole, but he's always kind of an asshole.
Yes.
But he's more of an asshole now. Mm-hmm. Why? Psycourse stuff, probably. It's a mystery, and we'll solve it as we go along. How do you feel about Garibaldi in this episode overall? How it's all executed and delivered?
Yeah, he's disgusting, but that's Garibaldi. And that's also frustrated Garibaldi, because he isn't back at work, so he's angry at that, and then he's angry during his examination because he wants to just get back to work, and then he's pissed at Sheridan because he feels like he's being left out of things, which he is.
And when he finds out why, he's not happy then, because then he has to be used as cannon fodder for Sheridan, who he's already pissed off at. It feeds in on itself. And since he doesn't have the ability to have inhibitions and just to look at things in a more calm manner, of course he's pissy. And that is one of the things I actually like on a rewatch factor when it comes to knowing that this is Garibaldi's
tweaked up personality
of, these are things we've seen in him before, but he's had the ability, as we do, to internally manage oneself and go, oh, and have empathy and have a sympathy and have ability to step outside of yourself and go, actually, no, But he doesn't have that anymore.
No.
So he comes off as a jerk, even when he's saying things that are accurate. Because we've had scenes, like in Confessions and Lamentations, say, where Franklin and Garibaldi have two different approaches to solve a situation that will rise in tension and drama.
Yes.
And they were both very level-headed about it. They weren't jerks about it. And both of them had great points. Garibaldi has great points to make in that council scene, in the war room scene, but he's being such a prick while doing it.
Mm-hmm. And you can't see past it. Like, you know that he's gone dark when the only person that can defend him is Zach, and he's too pessimistic for Ivanova.
Yeah, he even depresses Ivanova. She thought she was depressing, but wow, now Mr. Garibaldi's taking the cake.
There are so many quotable lines in this episode.
He used to be the guy that would ask people to watch Looney Tunes with him.
We see Daffy in the background.
We see Daffy in the background. This Garibaldi, he's too angry to do that. He has to be watching security cam footage
of
that freaky alien.
Just staring at stills.
Well, he paused it for when Zach came in, and he just keeps looking at this freaky alien. And you know what? I'm with you, Garibaldi. Lorien's a weird guy. He's got long fingers, has creepy eyes, and you don't know anything he's about because you're being told not to ask.
Species that you've never seen or heard of before. You're told just trust him.
The guy worries me. Everywhere the captain goes, he's there right at his heels watching. How do we know he's not pulling something?
Come on. The captain vouched for him. Said he saved his life.
I thought he died on Zahadum.
Yeah, well, after that part. Look, I don't pretend to understand it. I'm just glad they came back in one piece.
I really like Jerry Doyle's performance with in the medbay scene. The whole examination where you can see the glimmers of that fun-loving Michael Garibaldi from the previous seasons, and yet there's an arrogance there, an aggression there, and he feels bitter and left out. And yet when he's about to walk away, Franklin says that it's great to have him back, that, you know, he's missed him, and he pauses for a moment there. And the way Jerry Doyle does this, it's not too pronounced and it's super quick, but you can, it's almost like Garibaldi is processing that, where it's like the original Garibaldi would have taken that in stride and been like, yeah, that's great to hear. And they'll like smile
Thanks
and walk
for
up.
That.
That would have given him that oomph. But this Garibaldi, it's almost as if
it's another thing to be suspicious of.
No.
Why are you saying this now?
Well, I don't even look at it as that's a great actually way to look at it. I personally look at it, it's almost as if the Garibaldi we know is underneath trying to get it, and then the one that's on top is stopping it. So mm-hmm. you see this broken pause glitch in the mainframe of Garibaldi, and then he keeps going on. And we'll see more of that with Garibaldi as he gets literal, like, mind messages to him.
And but that is a scene where he gets another one of those glimpses back
into the past.
And that is definitely something that's linked. Those moments where he seems like his old self is almost always when he starts to get more flashes, because that barrier is getting thinner for a moment.
And to give Doyle credit even more so, when we have the height of his petulance and pettiness of going off to potentially die, to go off and arrest or escort the evil Kosh off the station, he does that whole song and dance of, oh yeah, I guess I'll do that, shall I? I guess I'll go fall on my sword for you, Sheridan. And I want to just say that Jerry did a really great job there of playing two sides, where the one side more prevalently of this is Garibaldi being a dickhead, being a bad person, and the other side of that sing-songy comic delivery that we are so accustomed to from Garibaldi, where that type of delivery has when played, has been very successful in the endearing side. That's something that, like, the way that Jerry delivers a line with that rhythm is what he did in Grey 17 is missing, say, when you had the more light levity moments or all of that.
When he has his feet up at the end talking to Sheridan.
Right? Where, you know, he's cocky. Because why does it have to be chubby air? Why can't it be thin air? Like, you know, why can't it be chubby air? Why does it have to be thin or thick or thin or blah? He has that cadence to him in the scene where it's the one we know, and yet it's also...
Yeah, it's familiar but off-putting.
I just really thought he does a good job, especially when you know what... why Garibaldi is the way he is.
Yeah.
It means that you have to look at Doyle's performance and say...
You examine it differently.
It's... And there's going to be more episodes to talk about this, but I guess this is a great entryway into it of... Because this is the first big middle... Like, Garibaldi giving the middle finger to the audience saying, you're not going to like me anymore.
Yeah.
Of, I think it's impressive... But very, very dangerous of a gamble on the writer's part, of JMS's part, to have a character halt in their progression. Like, that's the thing. He's going to halt now. He's going to regress. Yeah. He's going to stop being this person you loved, this person you liked, this person you wanted to follow, and he's going to completely bounce off of that.
He's an antagonist on the inside of the circle now, which is not something that we've had. Everybody on Babylon 5 was working together, but now... That's out the window. The Vorlon is against them, and in lots of ways, Garibaldi is too.
How do you feel about this decision to have basically Garibaldi, the heart of the group, be the knife now in that heart for the group in the entirety of season 4? Just basically, how do you feel about Garibaldi being... a character that you're not supposed to like anymore for a whole season?
I fucking hate it. I fucking hate it. Not because it's bad, but because he makes me so angry. And I'm so upset that somebody that I care about is broken. And nobody knows it. Nobody knows why. And neither does he. And it's heartbreaking and infuriating at the same time. So I fucking hate it in the best way possible.
What do you mean I say I still don't remember? I don't remember. Are you saying I'm lying about it?
No, Chief. I'm not saying that, and nobody's questioning your word.
Then how come nobody's grilling a captain, huh? He breezes in here, says he's back from the dead, feeling much better, thank you very much, and everybody buys it. Boy, howdy, that's great. Yes, sir, good to have you back. Meanwhile, I get the third degree, and are you okay, Chief? Every time I sneeze. Does this make any sense to you?
It's time to take out the trash. Babylon 5 style, or whatever it said at the beginning of that DVD description. And the trash is... Kosh, no? Not that Kosh.
The Vorlon.
The evil Kosh. It's time to take out the trash that is the Vorlon.
Ilmish or something like that? What?
Yeah, Yulkesh. It's never said in the show.
No.
It's just one of those things where JMS has a name for him, and it's like, that's his name, and it's like, okay, didn't put it in the show. By the way, still hate that Vorlons have last names, and I still hate that Vorlons have genders. If the reboot ever does come to anything, if it ever does exist, or if there's a universe where we get another chance at it, that would be one of my notes. Don't let the Vorlons have first and last names. Just one name will do. And I don't like the fact non-binary. That it's a he.
Yep, non-binary.
Just non-existent. I don't care. They're angels, for Christ's sake. They should have no junk. No junker in the trunker. But we're here to kill the Vorlon, and I don't know what happened in between season 3 and season 4, but somewhere along the way, JMS sat down and said to himself, because he's the only writer anymore,
yep.
He said to himself, and he cracked his knuckles while doing this. He cracked his knuckles and said, I need to make Sheridan cooler in almost every way. And I say that because when he is laying down the lay of the land and how he just says, we have a security problem, the Vorlon, and just has that growling, gruff delivery that Bruce has of
his haircut.
But the lines, the lines are so just badass awesome of just, yeah, we're going to kill this guy. We're going to whack
him. Nobody's done this before.
And guess what? I want to do it. It's time to kill this guy. He sucks. He's a piece of shit. I haven't had many scenes with him, but when I have, I've hated the dude. So have you. It's just something about Sheridan in season four that feels far more badass and less dorky. He's still dorky, but it feels less. How do you...
He's sort of a zombie.
Yeah, he's a reinvigorated... He's Jesus Christ,
yes,
thank you.
Yes, he's Jesus.
Did you get that from his first scene in the episode?
Yes. Yes, I did.
I'm going to come in with some bad news for people. I love this episode. That scene's terrible. That scene's awful. That's an awful scene. That's probably one of my go-to worst scenes in season four.
It's so functional.
It's poorly acted. It's weirdly directed. And even on paper, it's very ham-fisted in what it's doing. There's always biblical and Jesus allegories and metaphors in B5. I mean, our guy has literally come back from the dead, and that can bring that there. But this here, where he bends down and he lifts her up, and there's this almost like angelic swell to it all, and heavenly, kind of attention to it, and she's enamored. Didn't he die? Gag me with a spoon. I hate that scene. It's just so fucking corny to me.
It's so
And we have to kill Kosh, and Lita's here. She's a part of the group. She's a part of the plan, because they have to distract Kosh first. They have to let Kosh know that they want to attack him so that he feels like he has control of the situation. And so that is where they send Garibaldi in, knowing that Garibaldi is going to get his ass kicked. The security team's going to get their ass handed to them. So then they can send in the real dark horse, which is Lita, who has the telepathic abilities that she can at least hopefully block Kosh long enough so that they can bring him out into the mousetrap that they've set ahead for him. And what do you think about just all of this? Just... we've had this evil Kosh for a handful of episodes. Really, only season four they've used him to be an actual character. And Vorlons have been this impenetrable force. And now it's just got to the point where we've got to kill one of them. How do you feel about it all, and how it pans out?
It feels inevitable. The way that it's laid out in this episode, it's just like, well... yeah, it feels like the only option. They're not going to get him to leave Babylon 5. That's not a thing that he's going to do. So he has to die. And it's going to be very hard for them to do it. And in the end, they need Kosh's help.
Ah, Kosh.
Ah, Kosh. True Kosh.
The original Kosh. The remaining piece. I have had internal struggles with the murder, the assassination of the evil Kosh. Because it boils down to they bring him out into a corridor and zap him with electricity and then shoot him out of his suit. And then a bunch of CG swirls. And then a bunch of CG swirls happen. And I do have some problems with its execution, but there's also parts of the direction and execution that are just so superb to me that it evens out, it levels out to it being effective. So, like I said, I'm not a huge fan of the CGI swirling monsters growling and throwing a bunch of CGI lights at people. I'm not a big fan of... I didn't like it in The Long Dark, and I don't like it here, of just, oh, we'll fill a bunch of guys shooting PPGs at this one thing until it dies. It's functional. It has to happen like that. But I'm a bigger fan of these glorious shots of Kosh, this evil Kosh that the camera has, of him realizing that he's fucked, realizing that he has been led into a trap. That dolly zoom in and his head turning around and the music kind of fading out and pumping in and just them push it now. And Patricia Tolman, she got to do some stunt acting. Mm-hmm. We all know that she's a stunt person at heart. And so she got to jump over some boxes, some crates.
Yep, do a little fall.
All of that evens it out for me to being a great payoff to this, because I don't know, sometimes Babylon 5's action in terms of literal actors running around is very lackluster to me. Yet I also think that in my viewing of science fiction television, whether it's Star Trek or Farscape or Battlestar Galactica or SG-1 or modern shows too, I just don't give a shit when we cut to the real people action scenes. I prefer my CGI spaceship battles over the we're running around in corridors with our laser guns.
God forbid that's in a cave set.
Oh, if it's in a cave set, fuck me. I hate my cave sets and sci-fis. How do you fare with that in general, the science fiction action scenes?
It depends on what surrounds it. If it's something that feels like a big moment, I'm much more forgiving of it. If it feels like it means nothing, then I'm like, just move on, whatever it is. Like, I think it matters more to me what I go into the scene with, rather than what type of scene it is.
As long as the action isn't a substitution for actual material, it will be something I accept into my heart more. Hence, this also gets a tick in my box, because the sci-fi action shooty-shooty Patricia Tolman jumps over a crate stuff is in aid of an important plot. We have to kill this evil Vorlon. This is not a substitution like in Star Trek Discovery or Strange New Worlds, where it's almost mandatory we have to have one or two action set pieces in an episode, and it just drags down the pacing I've put my feet in cement and you've thrown me into the river.
And now we have this scene, and now we need the action scene, is what it often feels like. But this does not have that quality. It is a slow and methodical action scene for a lot of it.
It has atmosphere.
And then they go hog wild.
And the good Kosh comes out of Sheridan and it's a bunch of CG released. Crap. And none of that is really important to me.
OG Kosh is golden.
He is golden. None of that matters to me. What matters the most is Sheridan, again, sacrifices himself for Delenn. He dies, he's gone, and Lorien has to put his big fingered hand on him and give him the glow. Give him the glow up, Rachel?
Yep.
Is that a phrase the kids still use? Give him the glow up? That's a phrase, right?
Yeah, it is, but I don't know how common it is.
Kids, I know you're listening to us. You know our podcast now, Rachel. Rachel did inform the high school students that she teaches. She did give them enough information to hear the podcast. And apparently some of the kids heard me say stuff about sex toys earlier in an episode. And another one where I said suicide's okay.
The one that they were most upset by was the episode where you immediately got me yelling. And they were
which
like,
which one, Rachel?
They were like, why are you yelling at your husband?
I ask that all the time. Email in, people, yumyumpod@gmail.com. Email us with your questions and concerns about why Rachel yells at me, her poor husband. I've done nothing wrong. I'm a saint. Context is for kings. Yum yum. All the other ones I use to make Rachel fly off the handle. Sheridan dies. Lorian brings him back.
You're lucky you're blocking the door.
I'm lucky that I'm blocking the door. Rachel can't escape. She's stuck with me. Once I put the ring on that hand, she's stuck with me forever. But let's get into real talk, Rachel. Sheridan, he dies. He's brought back, but we get the important...
He's fatally wounded.
But we get all of the important reasonings for why Sheridan is alive again in the first place from Zahadum and in this moment from Lorian. We transition eventually into the sequence in Sheridan's quarters where Lorian reveals that he can give life, he can't make life, but he can give life, he can blow on those embers, he can help extend some stuff, but the universe is the only thing that can create life, that can bring things into existence. And so
do you think he had like 40 years originally and dying again halved it?
I read it as Sheridan already had this amount of time, and this is
just the max refill that Lorian can do.
I don't think it's a max. I always get it from Wayne Alexander's performance, that because he's this otherworldly, alien, ancient being, that to him, this is enough.
Yeah.
This will do.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how Sheridan goes about it, too, because, yeah, the reveal is Sheridan only has 20 or so years to live, barring injury or death of other ways.
Injury or illness.
He'll live for 20 years, and one day he'll simply stop. Stop. Thoughts on that, Rach?
I think it's a great sci-fi concept. I love it. Just the idea that he can give him this energy that, like, you know, Franklin's never seen before, but they can see it. It's not mystical. It's not magic. It's just energy that's working on repairing his cells.
And then one day it will stop. And he'll be done.
Because the energy will be depleted.
I know many people we've watched this with, I know you were like this too, but our former housemate Mark, who we've had on the podcast, our good friend Julio from The Contrarians, one or two other people, always squint at this and go, 20 years? Okay, I guess. And there's this feeling of, well, we're not going to really experience that in the show. There's always a level of, I guess I'm fine with that.
Yeah.
I'm not as devastated by it. And so
I won't see him die, right?
We're not going to have the series finale where we very, very, very much go to that and rip the audience's heart out and throw it on the ground and stomp on it a million times for not at all thinking that we would do so. This is devastating to look at again, where he's so Sheridan about it. He's so just, hey, 20 years,
Boy
that's
Scout.
Pretty good. He's a Boy Scout, yeah. He's so Sheridan about it, where, hey, it all works out because any time I spend with you is good enough. And where do you land on that type of attitude? If you were in this situation, what perspective do you think you would have? Do you think you would be like Sheridan where, hey, 20 years, in my early 60s, You would be Delenn?
I would be Delenn.
Wow.
That, it's not enough time. Like, yes, I want to spend all of it with you, but I always want more time.
I can understand that. I think it's, I think I'm like Sheridan, I guess, in that way of, like, look, of course I'd want to live longer, but if that was the case, I don't think I would fret about it as much as that. I think just say, when we look at it in terms of our relationship, say.
Yeah.
We've been together for 10 years, and I feel like we've had...
You would accept it. You would acknowledge it and accept it. But it's like, I would like more time. But I'm thinking of it from Delenn's perspective. If you were in Sheridan's place, not if I was in Sheridan's place.
But if you were in Sheridan's place, would you freak out about it? He doesn't freak out about it. He seems very chill about it.
Yeah, I would. I would. But I freak out about most things.
But wasn't my face enough? Coming back to it.
But also, like, we've got so much to do in those 20 years.
I'm okay with this.
But I'm not okay with this. I told you I was afraid that I would get you back, only to lose you. And that's what this is. 20 years.
I mean, it's a long time. It's 20 more years than I would have had. And at least I can spend most of them.
That isn't the only thing that happens in this scene, Rachel. JMS again.
They get engaged!
JMS again cracked his knuckles and said, I want to make Rachel Slawinski in the year of our Lord 2023 giggle and smile and clap with glee.
And be like, this is the most anticlimactic engagement they could ever do.
Don't you remember, Sinclair's?
For these two characters.
Is it?
It feels like it because it's what you want, but it's not what you want at the same time because it is very them. It is very much an echo of their relationship, which is, I think, what the best engagements are.
Yeah,
but the fact that he doesn't actually say, "Will you marry me?"
Oh, you need those words, and you need him on the knee.
I want that.
I like it too.
I like it too.
See, when you say anticlimactic, my eyebrow raised because this is exactly what I want of it, and in a way too.
At least it's not anticlimactic
to me because I also didn't think that they were going to get engaged in the series. I honestly thought they were going to do the thing that they always do in these sci-fi shows, where they wait to the very end for this couple to fully commit to one another. Oh, John Crichton and Aaron Sun can finally kiss now. Oh no, they've been frozen. To be continued. Like, they don't know. Episode 4, season 4, they're engaged. Maybe one day they'll get married, but they're too busy fighting a war. But they're together. They're committed. There's none of this crap. There's none of this, oh, will they, won't they? Oh, no, now they hate each other. Now they love each other. Oh, no, there's some sci-fi
concept.
They
do not milk the betrayal of trust thing that they set up.
So since I am conditioned by not just science fiction television, but by television standards, especially of the 90s, I didn't expect them to get engaged. So I can't say it's anticlimactic because I didn't even think that this would be a climax that they would actually work towards.
I was waiting for it.
I really didn't because they've only just kissed. I didn't think they would get engaged. Like, let's work it out. How many episodes did they kiss ago? It was like 6 or 7 episodes ago. Now they're engaged.
He basically said, I love you without saying I love you before they even kissed. Like the depth of their feelings.
Remember when I said he was cool now? He's such a dweeb. This guy kissed her like 4 seconds ago, and then he's like, "God, golly gee, Delenn, I love you.
I can't live without you. I love you so much. Your face brought me back from the dead."
Yeah, and I haven't even got my dick wet. I'm just talking about your face. That's how much
I love you. Oh, he's like, I briefly mentioned it, but I love so many lines in this, and one of them is his, where it's something like, if I love you that much, why wouldn't I forgive you?
That was a great moment and a great closure on their conflict that they had in the episode Zahar Doom, where she had betrayed his trust and she's still holding on to that guilt. He's moved beyond that, and now they can move beyond it together. There's no need to make a whole episode out of it. Just a quick fire line.
It's not even a whole scene.
It's just a line, and that's all we need.
That's not the juicy stuff.
we have to talk about someone very important and special and near and dear to our hearts. Somebody who I think doesn't get enough appreciation from us on this podcast.
Yeah.
We are doing our spotlight section, the section of the show where we shine a spotlight on an actor or actress that appears in a given episode, whether they're big role, small role, one-off, recurring, and we go over their performance, what we've learned about that actor and their career, any interesting pieces of trivia, and we have to talk about the voice actor of Kosh, who has been here since the gathering. They've been here, and we have praised them from time to time, but I want to do my due diligence, because this is one of the last real times that they are here in the show. Maybe they come back once or twice, and mainly archive footage, or like reused recordings, but this is one of the last times where we really get that flavoring of Ard White Chamberlain, I do believe it's their name is, the actor. And I just want to just spend the moment of talking about their performance throughout the entire series thus far.
Yeah, it's a little bit of a sidestep for him as a performer, which I find interesting because he is very much a voice actor compared to a live action performer. And he can use so many qualities within his voice to convey so much. Just the fact that you can distinctly see, distinctly hear as well, the difference between OG Kosh and fake Kosh.
You can, and there's several things at play here when it comes to the talent of the voice. There's an obvious vocal modulation at play with Kosh, and yet you can still feel the acting come through that. That was one of the things I really loved about Farscape with Pilot. That actor's voice was modulated, and yet you still really got the feeling of acting coming through, which can be difficult. A thing that I think is also praiseworthy is Kosh has to come across as this emotionless, mysterious, enigmatic kind of figure. And yet, just like with Leonard Nimoy as Spock or Mark Leonard as Sarek, you can still read intent and emotions and opinions.
Something's even underneath it all.
Even when they're playing it as if they're at a distance.
Yes.
Because if you don't have that in just the voice, you would just ask yourself, why doesn't he have an AI voice at this point? Because Kosh is never an emotionless robot.
No.
And that comes down to the voice that Ard White Chamberlain does, because he adds enough of an attitude, enough of an arrogance and mischievousness and kind of that I'm wiser than you inflection into each one of these lines that it always draws at least myself in. Now, what do you think and what have you thought about the voice of one of the big characters in the show? Because we always talk about these live action people, but this guy, he's been here since the beginning.
Yeah, it's something that I never question. I just go, that's Kosh. And it's that thing of his voice brings that character to life. Kosh feels like a character just as much as any of the others, but we don't look at his performance in the same way that we do with the other members of the cast.
Because he's a voice and he's playing a character that has very few lines given to them. And I'm not saying across the series, just when he's in scenes, his character by design is a character who says only a few things because that's all he needs to say.
Very, only the essential.
He's not having casual small talk about what he read in the news that day. And he's not saying, oh, I'm looking at Ion Vorlon in the newspaper.
It's like, how many layers of meaning can you get in one syllable with Kosh? That's the thing to dig into with him.
And I can't imagine the struggle it can be as just a voice actor. Voice acting's very difficult and it has a lot of moving parts to it. But this actor, who we will talk about their career, he has to do something that's super important, which is he has to come across like he's a god. Because a part of the appeal of Kosh is when he says these beautiful lines of dialogue, there's this element of this guy is an angel or a god, and yet also he's this creepy alien in a plastic suit that has nozzles on it. But there's always that underpinning through the performance that this voice actor has is Kosh is a god. He walks around and he is this seemingly benevolent, magnificent angel deity figure, and that's in the voice. That's really, you can really hear it when you go back to season one and season two. And then when you have him in conversations with Sheridan, where interludes and examinations, where we are stripping that back, and you can actually hear that Kosh is upset and afraid. And the juxtaposition is really damning and hard hitting, because we've been so used to him being Mr. I'm higher than thou. So to hear him be upset,
but also like very distinct from that, the moment when he's leading Sheridan into that the area before he gets the beautiful music, the way that Kosh says
a moment of perfect beauty,
yes, it's, oh, it goes straight to my heart.
And he differentiates the Koshes, as you said. My thing that I point to as how he differentiates the two Koshes is the attitude. And the attitude of this Kosh, the evil Kosh, is he doesn't give a shit. The other Kosh looked like he didn't give a shit, and maybe sometimes he didn't, but this one openly does not give a fuck, and that comes through in the voice. He just does not give a respect from whom.
Like, it's unimaginable. Yeah, there's a difference between being reserved and being removed.
He has opened an unexpected door. We do now what must be done now. His purpose has been fulfilled.
I do not know, and I haven't found it in my research, but I have no idea his relationship with Babylon 5 too well. I imagine they hired him because he's a voice guy, and this series has constantly had voice actors in it, whether they are from Western or Japanese stuff.
Floated on through.
It's been weird.
Wandered
on through. We've had big voice actors from the Batman animated series come in, and we've had a lot of anime voiceover dub people. So I just imagine he was just one of those guys where it's like, he does a voice. He'll come in and he'll do this voice. But I actually don't know too much about Ardwight Chamberlain's relationship to B5 and the B5 community. I'm pretty sure he's attended conventions in the past, but he himself is an elusive figure to me. I don't really think I know what he looks like. I've seen a couple of pictures here and there.
There's not many. And it feels like, it's like, oh, well, that's just a generic white man. I don't even know if that's really him.
And whenever I see interviews or commentary tracks and they talk about Kosh, they always talk about the character. And they don't, like, rarely do they talk about the guy in the suit. And rarely do I hear talked about the guy doing the voice. And yet Kosh does, like, Ardwight Chamberlain does, like, so many significant lines come from him. I don't know too much about how he got into Babylon 5, what he feels about his experience on there, what others felt about him in it. I would love to know from people who are a bit more familiar, because did you find anything in that regard?
No, I didn't investigate too thoroughly. I was trying to find some things to do with his career a little bit more, see how he fell into the Japanese dubbing scene / like rewriting
script stuff.
Scripts for English dubs.
I want to just say this. You look at his IMDb, you look at his Anime News Network stuff, and it stands out so much that you have all of these animes. It just goes on from 1978 to basically 2005, at least on IMDb, of just his voice acting.
I really liked I want to know the fact that, like, his IMDb descriptors, actor is last.
Of course.
He's got more credits as writer is the primary one, but he's got also more credits as a script and continuity department member than actor.
Looking at his IMDb alone for acting, there's one or two other things than Babylon 5 that aren't anime. Babylon 5 is the big one that he did that isn't anime. Everything else is practically anime. And it just makes me curious of when he looks at his career, he can sit back and go, I've done a lot for Japanese animation in the West in terms of voice acting and script editing and all of that. And also I did Babylon 5. It's just, this is the one big thing from the West that he is in. And it just baffles me that a guy, because usually when you see the anime dubbing people, a lot of the time, especially big ones, especially ones with a catalog like this, usually stick to that. And yet we also see people like Kim Strauss, the Green Drazi. He's here too, and he's a big voice over guy. It always makes me crack a smile to think about how there are these anime voiceover people who have, like, just randomly in their resume, in their CV, oh, Babylon 5 as well as Lupin the Third. And so there's that. So tell us a bit about Ard White Chamberlain's background and his career. So he's a big anime person.
Yes. He started, well, his voice... His first acting credit is Lupin the Third, The Mystery of Mamo, in 1978.
Okay.
And then he seems to have stuck around for a little while, came back in the early 80s. 81, he did quite a few things. He was very popular that year.
He was busy that year doing a lot of random anime projects. And Rachel and I, we're not as familiar with TV anime stuff. It's a bit of a blind spot, especially of this just
like,
time period.
It's like, oh, I've heard of that and I've heard of that. And, oh, he's in that too. That makes sense. Like, he's in a lot of ones that I know that are popular and appreciated.
He has decades of adapting Japanese stuff, whether they're video games or movies or shows, into English. And I don't even know, do you have this in your research at all? Does he know Japanese? Like, does he speak it? Does he know how to read it?
I didn't find anything that confirmed that, but I feel like he couldn't do this job without it. But I'm also like, yeah, when he started, they would have been like, you can read a script? Okay. Doesn't matter if it's in English. You can read English? Great, let's go.
And I know my good friend Bartek would probably have an answer to this because he's a big anime head, but I am also not too familiar with the people who can adapt Japanese media into English also being voice actors. For some reason, I think of it like voice actors are one thing and the people who do the writing for it are another. For some reason, I put a wall between those two. Why? I'm just not too sure. But Rachel, tell us a bit more. What have you found in your research of Ard White Chamberlain and his body of work?
I went with something a little different. Because we haven't watched a lot of anime, as you pointed out. There's not a lot of things that we are familiar with enough to discuss further.
He did do an episode of Angela Anaconda. Just want to say that.
Yes, I did also have that written down. That's one of his writing credits. It's like, oh, okay, you did that thing. So, one of these random websites, I don't think it was, I think it was listed on his Wikipedia and some other websites that I found. He was on an episode of Jeopardy.
Really?
Mm-hmm. So what I have is the questions that he was asked, and I thought I could ask them to you and see if you get the same ones wrong or right that
he
did. Oh,
no, I hate this. I hate this. Go on. I hate it. Go on. People, don't judge me. Don't you judge me. Give us 5 stars on whatever podcatcher now before you hear me fuck up something really obvious.
I'm not going to get Ryan to do the format of what is.
Oh, I hate Jeopardy. I hate Jeopardy.
Jeopardy's just not really a thing in Australia much.
Thank you, Australia. We still have Deal or No Deal.
Yeah, that's a different thing. I've just kind of got them in a bit of a random order.
Okay.
Arnold Schwarzenegger was born in this country.
Austria.
Yes.
He's Austrian.
Mm-hmm. Knick knack paddywhack, give a dog a bone. He came rolling home. Finish the lyrics.
Oh, I hate that. I'm bad with lyrics.
Knick knack paddywhack, give a dog a bone.
This old man came tumbling home. Right?
Yep.
Okay. This old man. You and I can sing that to each other from time to time.
Yeah.
That's a fun thing about our relationship. Sometimes Rachel and I will randomly start singing wacky bullshit nursery rhymes and stuff like that at each other. What's another one? Did he get that wrong?
He got that wrong. Yep.
Ardwight?
He said...
You can play a god, but you can't get that right, huh?
He said, what is this old dog?
Oh. Ardwight, no, buddy. Next.
What is the scene on the reverse of the Jefferson $2 bill?
I mean, as a non-American, I think it's pretty easy to answer that. It's the Queen's face if you roll it up and it looks like a whale sucking cock. For you non-Australians out there, that's a reference to the fact that on the Australian $5 note, the Queen's face is on it. And if you fold up the $5 note in a certain way, it looks like a whale sucking a big penis. And it doesn't look happy while it's doing it.
No.
The whale, that is.
The whale looks sad.
It looks very sad.
Yep. No. Think about one of the major things that Jefferson did.
Slavery? Is it slavery? Picking cotton?
No, that people are like, oh, yeah, he was so great. He did that thing.
I don't know. Be a president? Be French. He loved the French, didn't he? Was he the one that went over to France?
Yeah.
I don't know.
It was the signing.
The Constitution.
Declaration of Independence.
Oh, Declaration of Independence. Guys, I'm not American. Don't you come at me. I have to learn too much about your culture and you don't have to learn much about mine. Let me tell you about our version of Jefferson. His name is Big Kev. You see, Big Kev was this big guy. He used to say, I'm excited. And this is now the third time on this podcast about Babylon 5 I have referenced Big Kev. You do the homework now, people. Type in Big Kev and fall down the Big Kev rabbit hole.
I'm excited.
I give Falling Toward Apotheosis a yum yum.
Yum yum.
On our scale of yum being bad and yum yum being good, what do you give it?
Yum yum.
Yum yum.
I'm ready to talk about what's happening next time on Babylon 5.
On the next Babylon 5.
Episode 5, The Long Night. The DVD describes it as such. 6 billion lives hang in the balance as Sheridan launches a counteroffensive to the Vorlon Shadow conflict. Meanwhile, Ambassador Malari... Oh, not Wiley. Ambassador Malari unleashes his strategic gambit against Emperor Katagia. Oh, baby, I can already taste how that episode's going to be.
Does it taste yummy?
Oh, genuine tastes so yum yum that people should follow us on social media to catch up with us and let us know their thoughts and opinions on the episodes and what we've discussed here at Yum Yum Pod or Yum Yum Podcast. You can find all of this in the description of our episode, as well as our email address, yumyumpod@gmail.com, where you can drop us a line, give us your thoughts, queries, questions, concerns. As well as in the description, you'll find a link to our Patreon. That's right, Yum Yum Podcast is on Patreon, where we do exclusive bonus content. We have a group Discord that you can be a part of. We have watched, we have talked about Space Above and Beyond, as well as we are going through the Alien movie franchise. We've done the X-Men movie franchise, and we are giving our thoughts on a multitude of other properties, whether it is Farscape, whether it is Sherlock, whether it is Doctor Who, whether it is the best and worst episodes of Star Trek shows. Oh, occasionally it's not sci-fi? Like what?
Sherlock.
Sherlock isn't science fiction?
No.
But Rachel, I watched season 3 of Sherlock and it was pretty sci-fi to me.
I'm out.
She's out. I badmouthed Sherlock, and you can't do that to somebody who, when you first met them, had a little bracelet on their hand. That had a Sherlock thing engraved. Yeah. When I first met Rachel, she had a little bracelet on her hand, and on the inside, it had engraved on it a little Sherlock quote. Do you want to tell them what one it was?
No.
I can't remember. What was it? Was it Sherlock's real? Sherlock's alive? I can't remember. It was one of the Moffat-y things that all those teen girls were into in 2012. I cannot remember, but you know.
I do.
Do you still have that?
I'm not sure.
Next episode, we'll let you know if Rachel still has a Sherlock engraved bracelet. She was going to get another bracelet engraved with the Moriarty quote at one point, and it never happened, did it?
No. You shamed me out of it.
Our love got in the way of another bracelet, and that there is why we are actually the Yum Yum Podcast.
You're full of shit.
Oh, good eating to you!
Good eating to you!